So you've been listening to the nerds all day. This is the cool people. These are bloggers and talking about social software. We've got some really interesting talks today. We've got Paul Lenz from ThoughtPlay. He's going to be talking about his philosophy behind being truly democratic using social software online. ThoughtPlay's website, Who Should You Vote For, reached what, almost a million people.
Yeah.
During the, almost a million people.
Closer
to the mic. Sorry?
Closer to the mic.
How's that? Ah, I see. Sorry. So did you hear any of that at all? Do you want me to repeat it? Paul Lenz, he did Who Should You Vote For during the last election, reached almost a million people. I don't know if any of you did it, but if I could put here, I was supposed to vote Lib Dem. Seemingly most people
heard.
About
30%.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you can tell more about that later. We also, over here is Paul Mutton. He's going to be talking about his IRC bot, PySpy, which basically kind of infers and visualizes social networks. He's currently using it to graph out the social framework of Big Brother. And he's going to talk about how this can be used in other ways. But first up is my favorite blogger in the world. And considering that Technorati tracks, what, 14 million blogs, something like that, is saying something, his blog is just absolutely compelling reading. He's a fantastic guy. When we first met, I think he took my blood pressure within the first 5 minutes. It was
just a cheap trick to me when you get up.
It was a rather healthy one. It was 120 or something, which is rather good. So I'll let you get this. It's Tom Reynolds.
Just to let you know, I've never used PowerPoint before, so if it sucks, it looks tacky, it's my fault. Tom Reynolds. And I write Grand Banks of Reality, which is basically a blog about gambling service. First off, is there any lawyers here willing to admit that they're lawyers? No? Good. Journalists? Emma? No journalists? Yeah. Good. Right, because then you can't contradict me. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a journalist. I know nothing about employment law. What I do is, where's this there? I drive around and pick up drugs. Occasionally take them to the hospital, sometimes torture them first. But why I want to give this talk is basically the job which I do has a lot of concerns about patient confidentiality, and I managed to get a blog which my boss is quite happy with. If I swear, sorry. Right, first of all, we've got some people who think that bloggers are special. Okay, I am to be not one of them. However, this person is. Do you know who it is? Yeah? Ellen Simonetti, Delta Airlines stewardess who got sacked for putting up some pictures on her blog. That's apparently the story. I'll come back to it in a little bit. So, she got the sack. What did they do? They whined. And they moaned. And they wrote this wonderful little thing. Bloggers' rights. Yeah, bloggers are a special case. We should have extra special rights. And to be fair, I mean, no one should be fired because of their blog unless you can prove that there was intentional damage. Yeah. It's crazy. When really, all we need to do is be sensible. Keep moving along. Scobles mentioned that that Microsoft has loads and loads of bloggers and they've got their own policy. This policy is basically don't be stupid. So I say, let's be sensible. Just like that. Right. You know, I didn't have to go on my journal and look at cat pictures, but, you know, Drew's in it. A lot of people think that if they remain anonymous, they won't be bothered by law, they won't be bothered by their boss finding out, they won't get the sack or anything. However, it's ties in quite well to what Daniel Bryan was saying earlier this morning. which is you do get claims, you get people finding out about you. This is the rule that I started my blog with, right, as if everyone knows who I am, everyone knows what I'm writing about. And so far, I've not been caught out, touch wood. So if you get found out, you always wish that you'd written that your boss wasn't big-eared, fat, lazy git. Right. So if you want to be anonymous, that's all great. You can try and minimise your identity. One of the ways to do it is use something called InvisiBlog, which offers free anonymous posting and blogging. The problem with this is, I went and had a look on it, and the two most updated blogs were written by pedophiles. So if you want to hitch your cart to that particular horse, be my guest. There's also anonymizer.com, which hides your IP address. I'm sure plenty of people around here know about that. It's great. We use it on our mess, ambulance service mess computers, to access the unofficial forums, which are technically banned. Oops. Another way is to use pseudonyms. Okay, once again, don't call your boss many git, because when you get found out, they might not be that happy. Obvious, really. And identifying details. Now, this is where I got my comeuppance. When I first started blogging, I knew who I was, until I happened to swallow some blood. It happened to be HIV positive blood, and it tended to scare me a little. I put it up on the blog, and people basically put two and two together and realised who was writing the blog. People who knew me. Great, I got a lot of support for it. So what you've got to realise is, if you're part of a community and you're blogging about this, part of an employment community, let's say you're one of seven naked sheep shearers in the country and you want to write a blog about that. Well, those other six people, if they're looking for blogs about naked sheep shearing, they're going to come across your blog. So you will be read by your fellow new sheep shearers. I've got quite a bit of this off at the EFF, which is great, especially if you're American. Less good for us Brits. You're not me in the law. I don't know, I just like that picture. It's cute. Yeah, we got worried about life on defamation. This is why I asked if there's any lawyers. Libel is doing harm to someone's character. There's a huge definition of what libel is, and thanks to the BBC Action Network, I now know what that is. For those who don't know, exposing people to hatred, ridicule, or contempt causes them to be shunned or avoided, discredits them in their trade, business, or profession, or generally lowers them in the eyes of right-thinking members of society. As up if you're a right-thinking member of society. I'd like the record to know no one stuck their hands up. Libel does count online. If you write online and it's something libelous, the courts will come down on you like a ton of bricks. Best way to protect yourself against libel is to get your facts right. It's not libelous if it's not a lie. Just repeating rumours doesn't protect you. So if I read something particularly libelous in the Sun and then go and republish it on my blog, I could get done in the laws as well. However, it does amount to fair comment, as long as it's based on good faith, based on fact, and published without malice. Now, if you look at those three, you think, well, how about I've occasionally read the Daily Mail. Sun, you know, Guardian, Sport, the Intertainment Sport. Difference between you and the Daily Mail is, I don't know about you, but I've got about 50 quid in my bank account. Daily Mail, I suspect, got a bit more. So the people who get libeled by you will pull down their heavy lawyers with their huge amounts of funding and wipe you off the face of the earth. And why will they wipe you off the face of this earth? because if you get prosecuted, your honour has to prove you're innocent. It's one of the few cases in British law where you are guilty until you prove yourself innocent, and you're also not eligible for legal aid. Who still wants to write a blog? So don't get called lying. I love Live Journal. Okay, reputation. Now we're getting into the things that your company's really interested in. It's our own reputation. When I was on the radio, there was this crazy man who was opposite me. And I was saying how employee logs are excellent, and he was saying that how they suck. The fact that he runs a company that teaches people how to talk on radio and you could hear all that. And he called me a racist because of something that I've written on my blog. It wasn't, and you know, obviously it's not brilliant. But that really did worry me, because I thought there's one thing the ambulance service ain't gonna stand it to me being a racist. And I got back home, there's an email waiting for me from the director of communications. He said, well, you're not racist, otherwise I would have written to you before, and not only would you not have a blog, you'd not have a job. The thing about blogging is this, right? If I go down to my mate's house and tell him my job sucks, they whip me, like some people like that, they whip me, they feed me bread and water, they work me like a Trojan and pay as frankly shit. Well, if I'm just telling my mate, that's fine. If I'm telling my mate to stay in the pub, that's also probably fine. If I paint in 6-foot letters on billboard, they probably won't be too happy about that. And to be fair, putting it on the internet means that I may as well get a gigantic big laser beam one night, hang it at the moon, and carve my message into the moon, because that's how many people are going to see it. So what you've got to be careful of is wrecking the reputation of the place where you work. You know, I don't actually like cats. Companies as well as individuals have secrets. For me, it's to do with patient confidentiality. I'll blog about some of the things like how my drinks and plants, which is kind of topical now. But if you're working in a business which wants to actually get customers rather than have less customers, white man, confidentiality, industrial secrets, all of that. Is it in the public interest to reveal those secrets? Well, if you just want to tell everyone that your boss wears women's underwear, assuming your boss is a woman, it's not really in the public interest. But this doesn't emasculate your blog. You can still whistleblow. However, the best way to defend against whistleblowing is, in this case, I would go to the RSPCA and I would say, hey, Kellogg's Pop-Tarts, they keep little cats in it. Then I'd blog about it. Because I've covered myself under the law. It's really hard to blog, post-it notes, finally. Make sure you don't give your boss an excuse to sack you, and that is one huge cat. Going back to Miss Simonetti, I've heard rumours, horrible rumours. The reason she was saved wasn't because of the pictures which she got on her blog, it's because she was a complete party animal, turning up late and turning up and everything. I don't know. It's just a rumour. Please don't libel. Don't take me to court for libel. So, if you're going to blog, you're going to have to keep yourself white and white. Don't turn up to work late. Don't call your boss a fat bastard. Do a good job. And importantly, don't break your company's in their policy. If you're blogging from work, make sure you're allowed to. And don't say you're on the job. Now, squirrels I prefer. If you think you're going to get in trouble, now I was lucky with this. I didn't even consider this, and I just ask forgiveness rather than permission. But it's probably better to ask for permission first. Go to your boss, give them all the evidence about all the good things that blogging does. Look at Scoble, for instance, Chief Humanising Officer of Microsoft. Go to your boss, say, well, marketplaces of conversations and brands are dead and all that stuff that I have no idea about because I don't do marketing. Go to your boss and say, hey, boss, look, this thing's great, and can we get a policy about it? Blogging policy. Oh, dear. Here's what I've said. Apart from the thing that make clear that the views expressed in your blog are your own. It's all good, honest, common sense stuff. Be respectful. Be respectful of confidentiality. If you want a blogging policy, why don't you leave it out on a bag of £50 note? Stick it in your pocket, I'll buy one for you. And if you do lose your job, sign it up. Perhaps your blog will help you find a new and better one. I know three people who got a job just because of their blog. That's three people I actually physically know, not people who I read about. And your new job might be Shishu. Thank you. Oh, you can find me down the bar.
I actually owe him. I owe you a beer.
You do,
for the 7th of July. I don't know if you've been to school, but you're remarkable. You people, I love you. So I'm gonna buy one of you. Now let's have Paul. Are you standing up?
Yes, I will be.
So he's gonna explain his IRC bot. Hi, Spy. And I don't watch Big Brother, like most people who work on TV, so this is just going to go over my head.
Right, first of all, a quick thank you, because when I was asked for this, my special requirements list, I actually jokingly wrote down beer, and I've got some beer. It's nice and cold, but unfortunately there's no bottle in it, so I'm trying to help me out a bit later.
Anthony?
Oh, everyone scrambling in their pockets. Right, in case you've been living in a box and not watching television lately, Big Brother is a programme which is on Channel 4 at the moment, a reality television series. Basically, they've stuck 13 people in a house who obviously have no real career prospect, otherwise they want to stay at work. Every week, they vote one of them out, and if you're really, really interested in this, you can go and visit the official Channel 4 website. So what this talk is about is social networks. We all know what they are, pretty much. Basically, I'm going to be trying to create social networks that look like this, where people are represented by little circles or nodes, and a link between those indicates some kind of relationship between those two people. The problem with the Big Brother house is that, okay, you could watch it 24 hours a day and get a good idea of what's going on, but that's a bit sad. So, fortunately, someone else watches it 24 hours a day for me, and they type in what's going on, so I can actually read that stuff automatically and try and work out what's going on in the house. So the cool thing about creating this software is that I do not need to watch Big Brother. So, working out who is actually interacting with whom is a bit of a tricky problem, and I originally applied this to IRC chat channels, which is very easy to work out who was saying what. It was obviously less easy to work out who they were saying it to. So some of these simple heuristics. Heuristic is another word for dodgy guesswork. So adjacency is one thing. If I say something here and then suddenly someone in the audience heckles, then there's a good chance that they were talking back to me. Of course, they could have just been whispering to their neighbour, ooh, I like that guy's t-shirt, where can I get one? So that's not so reliable always. Direct addressing is something on IRC which is very easy to detect. So if Dave says, can someone ping me, and Phil actually says, Dave, okay, then I think you can guarantee that Phil is talking to Dave then. There's some other ones which are a bit less reliable in some cases. Indirect addressing detects when people are talking about other people from talking to them, and whether you should infer some kind of interaction between those two people is rather subjective. And particularly applicable to IRC and other chat systems is this notion of temporal density. If only two people are actually saying stuff within a very short period of time, then they probably are talking to each other and not talking to anyone else. So that's quite reliable as well. When it comes to actually laying out these networks, we want to make sure that unconnected nodes are not displayed, because we don't care about being no nodes. People who are related to each other, or there's some kind of interaction between them, they should be drawn close together, so we can actually see that in the graph drawing. And the strength of the relationship can be shown using redundant queues, basically how close the nodes are to each other, less transparency in the lines that join them, and bigger lines to make stronger relationships. All of the nodes have to be labelled, because what is the point of a social network with no labels? Okay, it may look pretty, but if you can't identify who is who, then that's not so good. And all pairs of nodes must be separated, because you don't want labels being occluded. So some of you may have seen this kind of thing before. We use this thing called spring embedder, which models each of those little circles as a charged particle. So if you leave them all on their own, they'll try and push each other apart and just keep going forever and ever. But when there's a relationship between two nodes, we treat that like a spring. So using an iterative simulation, we can actually lay this stuff out until it reaches an equilibrium. But we need some modifications, because not all social networks are connected. You may have several distinct subgraphs, and there may be no way of actually traversing those to reach the other ones. So to stop those subgraphs from just drifting apart forever under electrostatic forces, we just change the force model, so once they've got a certain distance apart, they just stop pushing each other apart. Don't worry about mass here. Basically, if there's a stronger relationship between a pair of nodes, then they'll be drawn closer together. So it's very easy to work out where the strongest relationships are. So here's an example of the kind of app, and this is actually from an IRC channel. It's a bit small, so excuse me, but there's me. And from the little emanating edges, you can tell that I've been talking to three people. Unfortunately, only two of those are real people. One of them's a IRC bot, so I really need to get out there more. But it gives you a feel for what's going on. We've got a couple of stronger relationships down here, so that shows that those two pairs of people have been talking to each other a bit more than everyone else. You can also apply this kind of graph drawing layout to channel similarity networks. So I know some of you here use the three node IRC network, and again, very, very small. Not even I can read it up here, but basically where you've got stronger edges, you're showing channels which have a lot of shared participants in them. So two of those closely related ones, I think one would be a Linux channel, and one would be about Ubuntu, or however it's pronounced. Shakespeare is a bit like IRC, although I think he came up with the idea before IRC. This is Anthony and Cleopatra, a book I have not read. However, from looking at this, I can see there's clearly something going on between Mark Antony and Cleopatra, which is, you know, what you'd expect from the title of the book. But there's also something going on between Octavius Caesar and Mark Antony, who Hermes is. And, of course, Shakespeare is like IRC. You can clearly, you've got a list of dialogue, in essence. You can tell who is saying what. You can tell what they're saying. But again, the problem is working out who they're saying it to. And just another quick Shakespeare example. Here is the Scottish play. Strong link between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, and Malcolm and Macduff. You can actually animate these things as the book goes by, so even without reading the book, if you look at an animation of this for a couple of minutes, you can actually work out who the main players are and where the main interactions lie. So yeah, how do we apply this to Big Brother? As I said, there are some there's some talented people out there who actually type in what's going on, and it appears on the Digital Spy website. A mate of mine, Andy Sepka, he's made a simple IRC bot which pulls stuff off that website and feeds it into IRC. So all I had to do was modify my own IRC, but from Pi Spy slightly. All of the IRC diagrams are drawn using a version of this straight out of the box. But I modified it slightly so it would treat the Big Brother stuff slightly differently, because basically you're getting stuff like Eugene says hello to Orla and things like that. It's very hard sometimes to work out who is actually saying what in that kind of context, but by breaking the sentences down and trying to work out which sentences involve more than one character and infer relationships like that. Then the IRC box stitch results on the web, and everyone who likes Big Brother goes, ooh, this is pretty. So this is what happened on day 18, or should I say day 18. And it's a bit cluttered in the middle there because they're having such a good time. But one thing worth noting is you've got Mary and Leslie out here. They've actually been evicted from the house, so they don't form a part of that dense network in the middle. Curiously, though, Vanessa is still in the house at this point, which obviously shows that she's quite boring. She was actually described as part of the furniture. And also worth noting is a very, very strong relationship between Saskia and Maxwell, who were, well, getting it on. A couple of days later, there's a strong relationship between Roberto and Derek, who are the two oldest people in the house. Clearly, they feel a bit overwhelmed by all these young whippersnappers. And again, Leslie and Mary have been evicted, so they don't appear in that network. On around day 30, Big Brother actually introduced three new housemates. And here they are. They form a little triangle down there because they've been stuck on their own for a couple of days. However, one of the housemates was introduced to them, Makosi, and she forms the only single link between the rest of the housemates and that small cluster there. Everyone else who's not connected was actually voted out. So yeah, I mean, it might look pretty, but what use is all this stuff? Investigating criminal activity is quite a good one. A guy called Vandas Krebs, I think, he actually created the social network of the 9/11 hijackings, and by looking at the clusters in there, you could clearly identify clusters where people were on the same planes. More entertaining, he creates pretty diagrams, and we all like pretty diagrams, even if they don't mean anything. There's also the educational use of graphs. You know, you can get a GCSE student and say, look, here's a Shakespeare play. 2 minutes later, they don't need to read the book anymore. You don't even need to waste 2 hours watching the film. And also, you know, you might better take some of this graph stuff and think, you can work out who's going to win Big Brother. So if you fancy a bit of a gamble, you know, just go onto that URL and place a bet. But I think the last word has to be that, someone I know actually applied this kind of graph layout stuff to visualise the patterns of email being sent within this company. And that included some very interesting artifacts. Visual inspection of these graphs really does show up suspicious stuff. This is why the police actually use graph layout mechanisms to detect suspicious activity. And he actually found a huge stream of emails travelling between two people. And as it turned out, they were having an affair. So the moral of the story is watch out, Big Brother is watching you.
Okay. Alright, finally we've got Paul Lenz. Now, Paul is going to use today to tell us about their new website, which is called What Shall I Read Next? And I think it will probably answer exactly that question.
Yeah, that's the intention.
So
should
we go now?
Sorry? Yeah, I think we can all leave. I'm parking the audience, obviously. Sorry, I'm not going to get the mic yet. I need to apologise. I'm the least technical person in this room by several orders of magnitude. My background is in marketing. So whilst I found today very interesting, I've understood about one word in seven so far. Just a quick bit of background. I started a company called ThoughtPlay, and one of our first projects was called WhoShouldIVoteFor.com. I don't know, just a quick show of hands, how many people here took tests on the site for the election? Wow, that's fantastic. essentially the aim of that was to provide a genuine source of information to help people with democratic decision making, but also to try and use the techniques that are used in viral marketing for a social purpose as opposed to a purely commercial purpose. And essentially we constructed a whole set of rules about how a good viral campaign should work and applied it to the social model of the website, which might look ridiculously simple and technically amateurish, but whilst it probably is those things, there was an awful lot of thought that went behind it. We seeded it by emailing out about 100 people on day one, and also quite a few people posted it on LiveJournal, about 50 people, and this kind of ties into the whole idea of how blogs can transmit information as well. By the end of day one, 5,000 people had taken the survey. By the end of day two, 20,000 people had taken it, and by the end of day three, 100,000 people had taken it. We were the most popular political site in the country, and that was before any of the national media picked up on it. Then some little-known technology newsletter called NTK put a link into us. Some people read that apparently, and also Poppitch featured us, and then we saw it in the national media. And so by the time the election came around, about 875,000 people had taken part. So we were totally blown away that, something like that could work. And we got very interested in the idea of what big social groups of people can do in terms of communicating information to each other, but also in terms of how they can actually help us make decisions. I don't know if any of you read The Wisdom of Crowds, but there's a lot of the philosophy from that we took to our learning. Our next project wasn't quite so socially motivated. It was an attempt to use the ideas behind The Wisdom of Crowds to predict the winners of horse races using Google, which might seem a bit strange, and on reflection it probably was. But the essential idea was that by looking at the frequency of trainer names, jockey names, and horse names on Google, we could try and make some kind of inference about how much people were talking about these horses, trainers, jockeys, and therefore how successful they were. So we modelled that fairly extensively and even put some money on it. Astonishingly, we didn't actually win anything. But I say, we didn't win up overall, we ended up down. But having said that, we actually did better than if you just backed the favourite in every race. So it was, that was kind of nice, but at the same time, it would have been fantastic if it just, we were making a fortune from it. So that was a little bit of a diversion, and we thought, okay, that was interesting. But how can we take that idea of social information and do something more constructive and worthwhile with it that will benefit not just our potential bank balances, but other people as well? And What Should I Read Next, which was finished coding about midnight last night, what sprung out of it. And essentially it's based on frustration with Amazon, and particularly the function of Amazon that said people who bought this also bought that, implying that therefore you ought to like what that other thing is. There's obviously a lot of flaws in there, in that people who shop on Amazon don't just buy stuff themselves, they buy it for other people. Also, they buy stuff they subsequently decide they don't like very much. So we thought, okay, rather than have a retail system tell people based on weighted numbers what they should like to read or watch or listen to, how about we get people who are passionate about a collection of books to give us that information and then build a database on that that's searchable by other people who can go onto the site, type in the name of one or more books that they've liked, and then based on this mass constituency of readers who've read widely, they can then predict books that they haven't read that they would like. And that's kind of the essence behind What Should I Read Next. So we haven't got very much data in here at the moment. As I say, I was up until about two punching in some, so it vaguely work for you. But by the end of next week, there's going to be a hell of a lot more in there. The idea is essentially that you go in, you stick in the name of an author or a title or both. It then references the catalogue on Amazon so that you get an exact ISBN match so we can use that for the database. And it then cross-references with the database to see other people who've read that book and liked it, what other things they've liked. You get a better match by putting in more and more titles, and at the same time you grow the database. So the idea is to try and create something that expands exponentially and becomes better and better and better at recommending things to people. So, as I say, there's not very much in there at the moment. To get the data, we also run a publishing company, and we've been soliciting from our website lists from hundreds and hundreds of people. We've been circulating it around blogs, we've been circulating it around our friends. So I know if I type in Pearl Earrings, Tracy Chevalier book, Girl with Pearl Earring, I'll click search. Oh, that is a very good one. Oh no, it's, even with my crass misspelling, it has still managed to successfully match Tracy Chevalier Girl with Pearl Earring. So I click on that. It says, okay, my favourite books so far. You can add more titles to refine the search, or you can click on what should I read next. And fingers crossed. It comes back with a selection of different things, and these are the Bronze Horseman, Glass Palace, Virgin Blue, Tully. One thing is, I mean, showing another Tracy Chevalier title in there, and something that we might well do is actually filter out titles by the same author on the grounds that the chances are you would have thought to check out books by authors that you like already. And the idea is that it's going to be slightly serendipitous, that that mass of people will be able to communicate to you titles that you never would have heard of by authors that you haven't heard of. We also have to factor for the Harry Potter syndrome in that Harry Potter is going to appear on an awful lot of people's lists. So the calculation that goes on in the background to determine what the most successful things are does take into account the overall incidence of a title away from that. Because otherwise, you know, if you try and search for a book that appears on 10 lists with Harry Potter, it might just be an indication that Harry Potter is on one in every 5 lists. So there's a little bit of factoring in there. In terms of taking things forward, this is, if it works and people get into it and it's successful, that's fantastic. But what we really want to do is try and get a crossover between the virtual world and the real world in terms of publishing. As I say, we run a publishing company called Verve, and there's a free book for anyone who like it. And one thing that we found is that we're overwhelmed with manuscripts, most of which are perfectly publishable and perfectly readable, but we simply can't publish everything that we get that's reasonable to publish. So what we're looking to do is actually create a democratic publishing model which would use fundable.org so that if you get 100 people to each pledge £5 or £6 or whatever the sum happens to be, but certainly a relatively trivial amount. I should go back a step. Basically, we stick up PDFs of the text of hundreds of books that we've seen which we think are publishable. People go on there, if they find stuff that they like, they can then link into fundable.org, each pledge £6 or so. When it gets to a critical mass, so it's a bit like Pledge Bank in this respect, but it has a commitment factor, then if you get, say, 100 people, that will trigger us to actually use printing on demand to print the book. It will get listed on Amazon, it will get listed in wholesale catalogues, and also we'll send everybody who signs up a signed copy by the author. So that's kind of where we want to take the next step along, to actually make it so that authors who don't stand a chance in hell of getting published at the moment can at least get a little foot in the door, and get a foot in the door based on public opinion. And maybe if enough people buy it, enough people like it, and it gets good enough reviews on Amazon, then a big publishing company will come in and pick it up and promote it properly. So hopefully at the end of this year that's something that we'll put together. I think that's about it. Thanks.
If it works, it's one of the things.
At the moment it's just like it feels as though it ought to work, and it's not bounty publishing, and the author can't just go in there and be the person who pledges it. Maybe they've got 100 friends together who at least pledge £6, which is so fair enough, then they kind of deserve to be published if they're that passionate about what they're doing. So that's kind of the next step we want to take it to.
So I'm
going to
stay with you, actually, just because it's easier. On your site, and I'll open it up to questions to you guys in a second. How many people are you going to need to use that before, what should I read next, before it becomes really, really valuable?
I guess we need about, from the list that we've already got, we've got about 5,000 titles, which sounds like a lot, but actually in terms of books, it's a relatively small proportion. I'm guessing we probably need about 5,000 people to have actively entered in a list of, you know, say a dozen titles or so. You can just put in a single title, but obviously we'd much rather people add in more to help build the community and book connections.
I'm going to open it up to you guys right now. Yes, can someone can you shout?
Can I have a future request? Can I put in a list of IPNs?
You can't, but you can email it to us and we can, because the admin interface is ISBN driven. We're guessing that most people aren't, or wouldn't necessarily go to the trouble of going on Trans or whatever and cutting and pasting the ISBNs. They much, would much prefer a simple, you know, type walker interface. But certainly, we're more than happy to accept email this slides to the ISBN, and it's a hell of a lot easier for us to do that way.
Have you considered doing the same? I mean, I realise you've got a lot on your hands already, but have you considered doing the same thing with theatre?
Our next project, our kind of interim project of this works, might well be what should I listen to next, and also what should I watch next, based on the same principles. But we want to give this one a work, see how it goes first. But we can use the same platform. It's just a case of putting a different skin on it and then starting to populate a database.
I presume you know of Last.fm.
Sorry?
Last.fm. You aware of them?
No, I'm not actually.
Oh, well, you should be. They have a plug-in for most of the common music players, and they basically just watch what you're listening to
right.
and then draw the same conclusions.
Oh, that's cool.
The problem with books is there's no plug-in.
Yeah. And also, you are getting... it sounds like a fantastic model, but you're getting a relatively niche... You're not getting anybody who necessarily listens to music, you're getting a certain constituency.
Go and have a look, it's actually really interesting.
Yeah.
And a quick comment about this, which is, I'd really like to be able to just say, yes, I've already read that one. When it suggests something I should read.
Yeah, ideally if you put in a list of lots of things that you like, then you could do that, but as I say, this is still our Hetzi Server's beta version, and we're still in the process of testing it, but yeah, if that sounds like a very sensible thing to have in there, and we can look to putting that in. So that you can just tick a box, highlight radio button or whatever, so that it just filters that out.
Then can you get the woman with the redhead?
Yes, what about attempts to sabotage the system to fill it with junk or whatever? Are you going to be especially vigilant, and if so, how?
We can see everything that's being put in, and so if someone's obviously trying to skew it, then we can delete this from it. So, we can just basically watch what's going into the database, and I think if someone is deliberately, if they're tedious enough to want to do that, then we can intercept it. But I think it's a ways of numbers thing, but if a sufficiently large number of people are genuinely using the site, and even if a minority try and sabotage it, they'll be outweighed by the mass of decent users.
Would there be some mileage into putting as well the books you know?
That is a really interesting thought. I like that one down actually, because you could equally have a corollary, which is don't associate me with things that books I haven't liked.
Well, if you hate this book, you might hate these other books as well.
If you hated this book, then we're not going to bother suggesting this subset of books, because they're ones that people who hate, who love the books that you hate, also love.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi.
This looks like something that I really want to use in my colleges. Please, please don't put it in PDF file. Please find some way of putting it on that isn't PDF.
Oh, well, you mean that the whole, if you get to the crisper mass? Oh, no, fine, yeah, well, we can put it up there as a TXT or anything. Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, have you considered mining that data and having other potential uses, other than just suggesting other books that I might like, somebody might like, other potential uses?
I think once we get to a certain critical mass, there's some really interesting trends that can be drawn in terms of the types of associations that people make, and it probably will help overcome some preconceptions about types of readers, because there is this perception that you get people who read literature with a big L but never read Jackie Collins, and I think that what we'll find out is that there's an awful lot of crossover, and there's no such thing as a typical reader, that people read a lot more promiscuously than one might expect.
What about the useful data around it, like the lists, people's wish lists, which do provide sort of coherent assemblies of books that they like?
Yeah.
Are you very wary of using that because it's theirs?
Oh, when you're actually like getting a chance and writing, it would
give you a
little. To be honest, I don't know if we could actually go in and can track down people's wish lists without knowing what their login ID was.
Oh, you're right.
Every time.
Thank you. you go from an email address to an ID to a wish list?
Right. But without knowing lots and lots of people, I mean, we actually know we've got a very big load of email addresses from the previous site, but I think it would be kind of ethical to use that to learn by hand.
But there are also publicly visible lists of my favourite books, my favourite Spanish novels.
That's certainly something we get. I mean, with the list mainly function on Amazon.
Yeah.
We've had a look at that, and essentially, some of them seem to be really quite good. A lot of them are my 12 favourite Harry Potter books, which are just all the Harry Potter books and then books about Harry Potter. And it's not something you comprehensively mind. I think it's something that you could selectively like. I think I'd have to talk to our IP lawyer about whether we could legally do that, or rather, if we did it, whether we get found out or wrong, which is probably no.
You had a question in the back. You might have to shout unless you can get back to
Have you thought of allowing users to tag books with categories like these? These equivalent sites for tagging websites like Delicious, where users are able to make up their own tags. So you could say politics and, I don't know, UK or. And then.
Do you mean by genre?
Sorry?
Do you mean by genre?
Yes, because someone might share favourites with me in a particular, in some sort of non-fiction, but have a completely different set of interests in the fiction world. So if I was able to tag and say, I'm interested in what they tag as being the thing I'm interested in.
Right, so effectively you're saying that you could have specific inclusions and specific exclusions. For instance, I don't want to see any books about political science because I'm not interested in political science. However, I am interested in art history as well as fiction. So, by all means, show me art history books that people would like, the same fiction books that I've loved. But don't want to show me political science books because I'm not interested in it. I think that's certainly something we could do. In the first instance, we're mindful of keeping it just really, really clean and simple because we just want people to be able to use it and hopefully get benefit. But there's no reason why we couldn't expand it and have a more advanced search facility on there that does apply some of that filtering.
Yes.
Do you know, and this rather sad fact that Amazon patented the concept of recommending a purchase to somebody based on what other people who made that purchase bought? Do you know how close you are to that at all?
Well, to be honest, they've got a transaction history of, 8 years with millions and millions of records on there. As I said, we're going to have 5,000 or 6,000. And I had 2 hours between midnight and 2 a.m. to start punching in the data last night, so we're not at that stage yet, but hopefully by the end of this week we can start doing some comparative analysis and seeing how different it is to what Amazon recommends, certainly.
Well, I was just sort of meaning, technically speaking, how close are you to being sort of planning out this patent or to what they've patented?
Oh, actually, have they patented the system? This is where I have obviously no technical knowledge, but we're just using some fairly straightforward analysis that I understand it, which I can't imagine is patentable because it's well be expressing my total lack of knowledge about this. But essentially it's looking at incidence weighting and just analysing it. It's just people who coded it just can't come up with it based on common sense.
Yes.
Question for the other ball. I just wondered how you validate the results of the Bravo without watching the program.
Okay, maybe I'll watch it a little bit.
It is all very subjective, that kind of thing. But on the whole, there's a lot of people on the Digital Spy forums that follow these graphs, and they do actually agree with, on the whole, they agree with what the graphs actually represent.
Did it predict the winner?
Sorry?
Did it predict the winner?
Well, it's still running, apparently.
Okay.
So,
can it help you predict the next submission?
I don't know. Possibly not, but it certainly shows people who are less active. I would conjecture that people who are less active in the community are less likely to be evicted immediately because it's only the people that are really annoying who get voted out straight away. They're the people that do actually interact a lot. So perhaps you can.
Oh, you have a question.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we're...
A question for both Pauls, actually. Paul Mutton, is there any hope... Is there any hope for the sort of graphs you've been showing us today in connection with what the other Paul is doing? Because I've never seen anything like that.
Graphs are amenable to all sorts of things.
There's an obvious connection that you could use the same connection system to plot
association between two books.
You certainly can, but perhaps graphs of fewer than 100 nodes are probably best to actually visualise. Once you start going beyond that, you can feasibly draw them, because some algorithms do have n log n time complexity, but they're just a nightmare to actually look at, and you'll get lines crossing all over the place. So for small stuff like the Big Brother stuff, they're quite easy to look at. If you're looking at just a few books and a few people, then yeah.
Or could you apply a filter that says actually anything less that has less than 5 or 10 connections will just ignore, so that then it's only the kind of the really popular books, without wishing to necessarily focus on that, you could then look at the connections between bestsellers, for instance, and if one's getting particularly sad, one could try and analyse different characteristics that explain why these types of books appeal to similar types of people, why there are no connections between them.
Yeah, I mean, you can break down graphs in all sorts of ways to make them easily visualisable. You could break down in a hierarchical fashion, or things like the Visual Thesaurus at visualthesaurus.com. I mean, check that out, that would give you a good idea of how you can navigate large graphs that only show a small portion of it at a time.
I've got a question for you. So, did you do any sentence analysis to see whether connection between those were positive or negative?
No, this is the interesting thing about it. It's definitely not rocket science. It's a very, very simple method to work out where the inferred relationships are, and I would guess that maybe there are some situations where it makes the wrong guess. But it also incorporates a temporal decay thing, so as time goes by, the links between the nodes actually deteriorate until eventually it breaks. So even if there are some false starts on your guessing front, it will eventually sort itself out over time. Considering how simple it is to actually, how simple it was to make these heuristics, I think it's quite impressive how it produces reasonably realistic graphs.
Yes.
Yes, just Paul, on the social networks, have you ever run it on the UK parliamentary debate record?
That's an interesting question. It's something I did think about. A couple of years ago, and I was just speaking to one of the BBC R&D guys earlier about it, and it looks like something that might be happening quite soon.
Is your software open source?
Yeah, it's all open source. If you want to download the Pi Spybot, which is the thing which will draw the graphs off IRC, you can actually get that from www.jibble.org/PySpy. If you want the version which does the Big Brother stuff, that's not on the web at the moment, so you can just email me for it.
Seems like the other session that's going out is that the case.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. I think we'll wrap up if you have, if you want to talk to any of these guys, I'm sure.
Can I just make a very quick announcement?
Yes, yes.
I just wanted to say that Danny O'Brien, subsequent to talk, has set up a pledge. She wants me to announce to you. I will create a standing order of £5 per month to support an organisation that will campaign for digital rights in the UK, but only if 1,000 other people will do so too. You can support this by texting pledge rights to 600022 or going to www.pledgebank.com/rights. Thanks for that. You all know.
Lovely, thank you.